I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Every American city wants to improve its schools. Although not many communities are satisfied yet with the progress they're making, there are some signs of encouragement, and we're going to find out about them from today's guest. Terry Mazzani is CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, where he led a $50 million five-year commitment to school improvement in Chicago. Prior to coming to the Trust, he was a school district leader in Michigan and California. Researchers at Rice University have been studying some paths to improvement, including school takeovers by mayors, and Melissa Marshall and Peru Shaw are with us today to tell us what they found. We'll talk about how to improve public schools today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Terry Mazzani is CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, the third largest of the nearly 600 community foundations in the country. The Trust awards almost $50 million in grants annually. Terry came to the Trust as Director and Senior Program Officer for the Education Initiative, where he led the design and implementation of the Trust $50 million five-year commitment to supporting literacy, teacher and principal quality, and school improvement in Chicago. Prior to joining the Trust, he led improvement efforts in school districts in Michigan and California. Terry, what does the philanthropic picture in America look like today? Who's giving, who's receiving?
Today, the world is very rosy when it comes to philanthropy. It's really part of the ethic of our society, and in this past year, a record high $250 billion were given, which is up 5% from the year before. Of that, $187 billion, about 75%, was from individuals and $29 billion from foundations.
And then corporations make up, I guess, a very small percentage.
A smaller percentage of that. The main areas of giving are education and health. The one disturbing trend from these numbers is that giving for human services has been declining. So couple that with a reduction in public funding, federal dollars for that, it makes for a more difficult situation for the basics of food and shelter and access to health.
Why is that? And any sense of why those declines in human services?
No, I don't really get a picture for why that is. There's been a resurgence with the response for the disasters, but that's fairly localized. And again, you've got a situation where the private dollars will never equate to what's required from public funding. You know, if you look at $1 billion raised from private sources, you're still looking at a price tag of over $200 billion and counting.
Yeah. Tell me, what is the role of a community foundation in the place it lives?
Community foundations are a remarkable creation. The Chicago Community Trust is celebrating its 90th anniversary. We're only a year younger than the Cleveland Foundation, which is the granddaddy of all of us. And we started as this noble idea to serve as a steward of a community endowment, serving the changing needs of the community over time. So we're, in a sense, the long-term savings account of a community, and we use those endowment resources to make grants.
And you represent donors who have their own funds and direct those funds, and then you represent sort of a broader charge, I suppose, is one way to put it, in terms of giving. Is that correct?
As a foundation, we're fortunate to have a fairly sizable endowment that's accumulated over the 90 years, which means that we do significant what's called discretionary grant making. And we have a growing number of donors who are utilizing the Community Foundation as a vehicle to help their charitable giving into the community.
The face of communities certainly is changing, and people are entering community life in a way that gives them discretionary dollars to invest in the community in a philanthropic sense. And tell me what you've done at the foundation and what other foundations are doing in terms of bringing new people into philanthropy, minorities, young people. How do you reach out to those people?
I'm very proud of the trust record there. We have created two initiatives, the African American Legacy Initiative and Nuestro Futuro, our Latino Heritage Initiative, which are boards of civic leaders from the African American community and the Latino community in Chicago to assemble endowments that are dedicated towards the needs of our African American residents and our Latino residents, and those boards then engage in grant making. We've just finished our first round of grant making for the African American and Latino funds, getting out over $100,000 each into the community.
I know you said corporate giving is really a very small part of the philanthropic scene, but we often hear much about corporate giving. Google just announced the creation of its foundation, and I noticed that their two areas of focus will be global poverty and the environment. And certainly that reflects in many ways the nature of Google's business. It is a global business. I'm wondering what you're seeing in Chicago in terms of the changing nature of the relationship between corporations and their community. Chicago, in many ways, I think, is a special place in terms of corporations still seem very, very concerned and involved with the community here. But I'm wondering if you're seeing any changes.
Chicago is very fortunate to have an active corporate community. It's part of the ethic of being a corporate citizen here. New CEOs to the area are very quickly indoctrinated into their responsibility to serve on not-for-profit boards, to sponsor events, and to give back and encourage their employees to give back. So we're a different circumstance than many other cities that don't have much of a corporate background. When I was in Oakland, California, Clorox was the main corporation. And so with the public schools, we were always knocking on their door. And I know that got tiresome for them, being a single entity to try to support a lot of needs in the community. Overall, with the Google example, I think there is a recognition that we are a very affluent country and we have a responsibility around the globe to address those issues. Community foundations are the other face of that. Our job is to serve as caretakers for the local needs and local issues. And in Chicago, we partner extensively with our corporate colleagues to mount larger efforts to address specific needs, be it education or community development, job training. The CHA Plan for Transformation is one example where we've pooled together and led by the MacArthur Foundation to work on how do we help the former residents of the CHA housing to now move and successfully move into the new mixed-income communities.
Mm-hmm. Chicago Housing Authority, the public housing residents that are being, I don't want to say displaced because it has a negative connotation, but old housing authority units are being taken down, removed, and new ones built.
Well, and it's new mixed-income communities with both market-rate, affordable, and public housing, all within the same block, all within the same development. So it's a challenge as the requirements to move back include things like educational milestones and employment, job training, and those dollars were not available when the federal grants, the HOPE 6 grants, were made to support the bricks and mortar part of this work. So the local foundation and corporate community has partnered together to provide the human services that are required to support individuals in this transformation.
Mm-hmm. We visited earlier this year, and you showed me a book. And you said, this book is really shaping all of my decisions. And the name of the book was Global Chicago. Tell me how that idea, Global Chicago, is in fact shaping your philanthropy.
Part of our responsibility is to look over the horizon to see what the emerging needs will be in the community. And as we look at the landscape for Chicago, the changes in the employment structure, the nature of the workforce, the communities, one of the themes that stands out is that Chicago has become a global city. that has significant implications for the nature of the community itself. For instance, there is now a concentration of highly skilled specialists in the financial professions, legal professions, other professional services that are interacting across the world through corporations and through countries to provide a set of highly specialized services. To be employed at that level places a premium on education. And so for residents of Chicago to be able to compete globally and to be able to create a city that itself can compete for the jobs, that type of high-skilled professional job in a global competitive arena, means that we have to promote greater emphasis on education and higher education. If we don't do that, there will be an increasingly widening gap between the low-skilled wage jobs of the service providers and the high-skilled, high-wage professional employees.
Well, you came to the Chicago Community Trust as the point person on education. Tell me what role the Chicago Community Trust has played in Chicago public schools.
When I came to the trust 5 years ago, the board had just finished a strategic planning process, identified education as the top priority for metropolitan Chicago, and they invested a commitment of $50 million over 5 years to try to improve the educational outcomes for young people in this city and the region. My task when I was brought here was to develop what those priorities would be. We were fortunate to build upon the work that MacArthur had done for 10 years during the 1990s and the Annenberg Challenge in the later half of the 90s. Those two efforts cultivated a lot of interest and an awareness, a fertile environment for school reform and school change efforts. Where we were able to step in then is to focus very precisely on the things that matter for teaching and learning. So we took a content focus on literacy. The basic tool of learning is reading. Then we focused on high-quality leadership and high-quality teachers in the classroom. And then finally, to create an opportunity of parental choice, we focused on alternative models of schooling, supporting the newly emerging charter schools, contract schools, and also the Catholic and private school networks in the community.
You're listening to Smart City. Terry Mazzani is CEO of the Chicago Community Trust. It's immediately obvious why literacy, high-quality leadership, and high-quality teachers are important. Why is parental choice important?
It creates an opportunity to place parents in a decision-making role relative to the education of their children. So instead of automatically going to your neighborhood school because that's the postcard you receive from the central office directing you there, now you've had to engage in a little higher order thinking about what works best for your child, meets your child's interests and learning needs, and then actually consciously making that decision. So already the parent has increased ownership of that school, a greater likelihood that they will continue to participate in school activities, parent-teacher conferences, volunteer at the school.
Doesn't it also create pressure on school systems to get better?
Well, that's still an open issue. In Chicago, where we've got 600 schools and we've got a little over 20 charter schools now, it's not enough of a critical mass to exert that sort of pressure. We view it as much, though, that it does create demonstration sites, that a block away from a traditional failing public school is this new public charter school that has dramatically improved results for the same student population, the same community, that allows leaders within the education system to make the case that you cannot use children as the excuse. In fact, there are other reasons why a school is failing.
You say you have $10 million a year average to spend. The Chicago Public School System's budget annually must be...
$5
billion. $5 billion. So, Terry, how do you take $10 million and influence $5 billion?
The word influence is exactly right. That's one reason why we're focused so tightly. We try not to do all the curriculum. But we start with the top. We've built a strong partnership with Arnie Duncan and Barbara Eason-Watkins, who run the Chicago Public Schools. And we're fortunate as well that they've been in these positions for 5 years, building on the tenure of Paul Vallis for another five before that. So we have wonderful continuity. And with that leadership, we're able to focus those resources to leverage or basically cause how the school system deploys its resources to go in a different direction. Literacy, as an example, when we looked across the landscape, the expertise for how do you create high-quality instruction in teaching reading really resided outside the public school system. From prior downsizing, the system had really reduced its professional development and curriculum offices. So we saw there was great talent and leadership in the universities in the Chicago area, and we created a partnership of six of those universities with a newly created office of the Chicago Reading Initiative in the central office, and it was that partnership then that provided the focus and continuity for them to launch a system-wide reading initiative that has made significant impacts on the reading scores here in Chicago.
When you invest your dollars, do you insist that Chicago Public Schools in some way readjust the way it's spending its dollars?
To stay with that reading project example, over a three-year period, our grants totaled $8 million. The school system and the local schools, there were 46 schools in this project, they invested $24 million. Mm-hmm. So we insisted that the local schools budget a reading specialist and have a line item in their budget for professional development for all of their staff. The school system also had to budget a reading specialist and other costs. So we had a 3-to-1 leveraging of our foundation dollars, and we contributed to supporting a direction that was first and foremost on Arnie Duncan's priority list.
Now, Chicago Public Schools are probably one of the few schools in the country that would actually have the option at a local school building level to invest dollars differently.
That's correct. In other situations, a partnership would need to be directly with the superintendent and the school district itself, and then, depending upon the philosophy of that district, whether or not things were mandated for the local schools or else schools were generally invited in to opt into something voluntarily.
Do you think that, again, you're a former school administrator, now on the other side, are these four areas the big leverage points, or are these simply the ones you decided at the trust to leverage school improvement, which everyone's seeking?
Across the board, it's a consensus in the literature that if you start with great schools have great principals, there is no way around obtaining high-quality leadership, and that's why we invest very heavily in some innovative projects here to build great leaders. It is much more looking like a medical school experience with a 1, 2, or 3-year practicum. It's not something that you can learn from a classroom and then go out and apply those lessons into a live school environment. Then teachers make all the difference in the world, and we have to focus not only on their instructional abilities, but the content that they have, especially in middle grades and high school. Teachers have to have the expertise in math or science, social studies, history. They have to be experts in their own right in order to be able to teach curriculum at a deep enough level to challenge students and to prepare them for the choice of college.
Given the culture of schools, given the pay, can you attract enough teachers and enough principals to do the job the way you say they need to do it?
one of the examples here in Chicago, when we started 4 years ago with this grant making, at the start of the school year, there were over 2,000 vacancies filled by long-term subs. This current year, because of efforts that they've made on the recruitment and development of strong pipelines of high-qualified teachers, they had 16,000 applicants for 1,600 vacancies. And kind of mindful, 4 years ago, we should be in the middle of a tremendous teacher shortage right now. That was the rhetoric at the turn of the century. And in fact, to have 16,000 applicants for 1,600 vacancies means that the system has a lot higher quality applicants to screen and look at. So to me, the heart of the matter is, ultimately, it's teacher conditions. It's the ability of a teacher to feel that they can control their curriculum, that the quality of life within the school is a very nurturing and supportive environment, that they have great leaders who respect their professionalism and support their ongoing training, provide them with the resources, the educational materials that they need to deliver the curriculum of their dreams. It's those pieces coming together that are required to retain the high-quality teachers.
What mistakes have you made?
In one way, I could say it's too early to tell about mistakes. We're really wrapping up our fifth year of our grant making, and like I can't tout any great achievements at this point, you know, until we look long term and see the results of this. In a sense, I don't think we've made any major missteps because we've been informed by now over 20 years of research and experience from the era of school reform that started in 1983 with the nation at risk.
But you've raised two real dilemmas. One is we're spending a lot of money on schools. You've spent a lot of money in 5 years, and you're not sure what you've done works. So how do you know if something's working? I mean, what's the time span? How do you develop the public patience to know?
There are immediate indicators. With the charter schools and contract schools that we've started, they pass a parent test. You walk into those schools as a parent and you said, I want my kid here. There's one type of benchmark there. And then in the reading project where we took 46 schools, these were schools that have historically had scores of 20 to 30% of the students scoring at or above grade level. We've successfully moved more than half of those schools now up into the 50 and 60% of the kids performing at or above grade level. So to take this really hard-to-move population of schools and get more than half of them moving is an accomplishment there. The Academy for Urban School Leadership, with its flagship school, the Chicago Academy, has now produced over 80 high-quality teachers who have been groomed in a medical school residency process for teaching, and they've opened up a brand new school this year, the Tarkington School, that is populated with these teachers and National Board certified teachers that we've also supported to go into a community that had experienced only failing schools and now has a high quality school starting from day one. So those are the sort of things that we have as anecdotal. We've invested money in a formal evaluation of our grant making. That'll take a couple of years to mature.
You mentioned also the problems of continuity. Certainly that's a problem with, it's interesting you said, Arne Duncan, 5 years as superintendent, we have continuity. 5 years is not a lot of continuity in a number of industries, but it certainly is among superintendents. What's to be done about that? Change in governance? We need more continuity. I'm sure you would agree. So how do we get it?
Chicago is fortunate that the mayor stepped up in 1995 and assumed responsibility for the public school system. That's the base of continuity here. In other communities like Boston, where Tom Paysant, which I consider the dean of public school superintendents, he's been there, I think, at least 10 years, and he has extraordinary support from the mayor, from the school board, from local officials. in the absence of direct mayoral control of a school district, I think that what's required is for the civic leaders to come together and, in essence, make a pact with the school board, with the local governmental leadership, and say, we want to do a search, get what we feel is the best leader that we can find, and then stick with that person for a five-year period or longer, and use that group of public advisors, stewards, to buffer the day-to-day, year-to-year politics that interfere with a superintendent's ability to focus on a longer-term change agenda.
Which cities have urban public school systems that you feel are making progress?
Outside of Boston, I don't want to kind of really say, because they do kind of come up and down depending upon a particular short term of a superintendent. You know, for the long haul, smaller districts, there's a unique one down in Brazosport, Texas, which Dow Chemical worked with and exported to the school system their work with continuous improvement and total quality, and that transformed the outcomes that they've got with student learning in that system. Other than that, the bright shining stars of the mid to late 90s have been replaced and turned over, and so districts kind of tend to rise for a while based upon the new plans of a superintendent, and then when that person leaves in 2 to 3 years, then they settle back down to a fairly mediocre level of performance.
Why is school improvement so difficult?
Because it's so difficult. It's a very complex enterprise. Schools are the focal point of a community's value system, a community's political system, their economic system, and they finance the ability to have a tax base or not have a tax base. There are a lot of forces that come into play, and then parents have to play a role, the school leaders have to play a role, the teachers play a role, the larger community needs to recognize that raising children in a school is a 6, 7, or 8 hour endeavor, and then there are things that have to happen before school and after school, and what happens in the child's home life. All of these factors come together. The school is the one publicly accountable entity in this entire equation, shouldering the burden of the expectations of an entire community.
What should other philanthropists who want to influence public schools learn from your experience?
First off is to decide if they can be committed to the long run. Where you see foundations linked with public school systems over the long haul, they do get results. Then when the foundation becomes a partner, it's not something you can do to a school system. Chicago floundered for many years when the foundation stayed on the outside and did not come in as a partner. It was more of a critique and a blaming of the system. We've been very deliberate about partnering with public schools and with the leadership of the public school system, and then focus as tightly as you can on the core activity of teaching and learning. And then the fourth piece would be in terms of recognizing that bureaucracy is the enemy of innovation. It's the protector of the status quo, and that you may have a superintendent and his or her top leaders on a advisory board leading this, but the individuals below them in the system who are still operating off of old scripts can either overtly or inadvertently just undermine very significant factors. One example here in Chicago where, as a result of a large grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we've been creating now over 20 small high schools with a student population of 500 students or less. The message didn't get down to the student demographics office, and as a result, they were redirecting students from overcrowded schools to these small schools and moving past the cap of 500 students. And so there's a situation of change brings about change for every facet of the organization, and a superintendent may not have the ability to reach all of those pieces simultaneously. And that's where the patience and perseverance of a foundation to hold the course and serve as a watchdog to hold the system accountable for its end of the agreements that are required to improve student achievement.
Do you plan to renew your support?
We are just entering our board planning process for a new five-year plan. The feedback that I get from across the community is that education still remains a critical priority, and referencing our discussion about Chicago as a global city, in one sense, more than ever, we need to change the educational outcomes. We need to have more students graduating from high school, ready to move into college, having the aspiration to obtain a college degree. But we're just starting that process, and so the exact proportion of our giving for education, I can't say at this point.
Terry, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you for inviting me here. It's been a pleasure.
Terry Mazzani is CEO of the Chicago Community Trust. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about the most liberal city in Texas, and you're likely to be surprised. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Melissa Marshall and Peru Shaw about how to improve public schools by stopping the policy churn. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he provides us with urban insights from around the country. Otis, who would have thought? Dallas more liberal than Austin?
Austin never thought that before. This comes as a result of a study that is what I call interesting without being particularly important. In fact, the most important aspect of what I'm about to tell you is that it shows how poorly national politics translates into local politics. There is a group out in Berkeley, California, called the Bay Area Center for Voting Research. They normally study San Francisco Bay Area politics, but they decided they'd look at all cities of 100,000 or more population around the country and classify them as liberal or conservative based on the way the voters voted in the 2004 presidential election. If 55% voted for Kerry and 45% voted for Bush, then that's a more liberal city than it is a conservative city. So it's a pretty simple scale for deciding these things. But when they lay out the percentages of voters in places like Boston, Massachusetts, or Birmingham, Alabama, guess which one came out more liberal on their scale?
Surely not Birmingham.
Birmingham came out as more liberal than Boston on their scale. Detroit came out as more liberal than Berkeley, California, and hard to believe, but Dallas came out more liberal than Austin, Texas, on their scale. The most liberal city in America, according to the Bay Area Center for Voting Research, is the city of Detroit, where 94% voted for either John Kerry or some other liberal presidential candidate in 2004. And the most conservative is Provo, Utah, which had the most lopsided conservative votes, 86% for Bush or another conservative. So what makes a city liberal and what makes a city conservative? They say it's demographics largely. If they have a large African-American population or single adults or substantial poverty, or they're the home of large universities, they tend to be more liberal. If they tend to be overwhelmingly white, married, middle class, or in smaller metropolitan areas, then they tend to be more conservative, according to this scale. So that's it. You know, hard to believe. The city of Austin, whose unofficial slogan is Keep Austin Weird, is considered to be more conservative, according to this scale, than button-down Dallas, Texas is.
Maybe the problem with this study is it came from Berkeley.
That's what somebody suggested in Austin. They said they think maybe somebody in Berkeley is one toke over the line.
Well, it's an interesting study nonetheless.
Yeah.
Thanks for finding it for us, Otis. We'll talk to you next week. You're listening to Smart City. Melissa Marshall and Peru Shaw are co-authors of the new report, Keeping Policy Churn Off the Agenda, Urban Education and Civic Capacity. Melissa is assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Rice University, and Peru is a doctoral student there. Reforming our public schools continues to be a hot topic for most cities, but we never hear much good news in terms of improved student performance. Melissa, why is sustained reform so difficult in urban school systems?
Well, I think there's probably a lot of reasons for that, but one of the key ones that's being talked about a lot these days is problems with the governing arrangements of local schools. And a lot of conflictual politics surrounding the stakeholders who are primarily involved in determining what the educational problems are and trying to figure out what the best solutions to those problems are.
When you say problems with governance, what are those problems?
They can range from having a lot of conflict on the school board to having conflicts between the school boards and the local elected officials and city council or mayors. There's lots of conflicts between unions and school boards and parent groups, and there's just a whole range of different groups that tend to be contentious when it comes to school politics.
But is there anything, Paru, that can be done to eliminate that conflict? I mean, isn't conflict inherent in our government?
Definitely. But school reform and education policies in general are unique in that some policy areas have fewer stakeholders or interested groups, and they have more common interests. Education policy spans a variety of different policy areas and interest groups in terms of parents who have different interests than perhaps teachers and teachers unions or school administration or school board or the governing body.
Well, you make a good point. There certainly are perhaps more constituents and more passionate constituents around schools, and yet I'm not sure how you eliminate that conflict. That's something you've been looking at. Melissa, what have you found?
Well, one of the things that we found in our study was that, first of all, a lot of cities have trouble getting these different groups to identify who the stakeholders are. And we found that in cities where the mayors tend to have more of a primary role in school politics, that they seem to have a better chance of getting more agreement among the other stakeholders, maybe sustaining that agreement and that cooperation, and maybe bringing other groups into the governing body.
What is it about a mayor that makes that position more effective in driving consistent school policy?
A lot of the problems that schools face are outside of the arena of schooling, actually. For example, there's a lot of poverty in urban school districts. There are healthcare problems. There are joblessness problems with parents. And schools really don't have the capacity to deal with those problems in a way that, let's say, a mayor or a city government can, because mayors have broader networks. They're more connected with business interests. They have more control over revenue policies. And they have a greater capacity to really formulate policies that are more comprehensive, and perhaps because they tend to be in office longer than, let's say, superintendents, they can sustain these initiatives over a longer period of time.
I've wondered, in situations with mayors being the primary influencer of schools, some mayors, of course, have taken over, if you will, their schools. Is it true that if you have a good mayor, then you may have a good school system? If you have a bad mayor, I mean, do you have a bad school system? Or is there something about just simply the office of mayor and the influence the mayor brings that it somehow works its magic?
I think that the office of the mayor certainly gives leverage to school systems in trying to address some of the problems that they face. You can have unpopular mayors who don't have the support of these different groups, which would then limit their influence, their capacity to govern, their capacity to get other groups to go along with reform initiatives. So I think that it's a combination of both.
But you would agree that not every mayor is qualified to do that?
Yes.
Peru, tell me about the systems that you studied.
The school systems that we studied were originally part of another project that was called the Civic Capacity and Urban Education Project. It's 11 big city schools districts, each that have faced over the last 20 years serious educational problems in terms of school achievements, student dropout rates, and all the other urban school problems that we find in other school districts. And we wanted to use those same 11 cities to further understand the argument that was made by the original project in terms of the relationship between the ability of community organizations and local businesses and politicians and the mayor to come together and solve school problems and the ability to get those types of school reform initiatives on the agenda.
Peru, tell me quickly the 11 school districts you studied.
Baltimore, Detroit, Boston, Pittsburgh, Denver, Atlanta, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., St. Louis, Los Angeles, and Houston.
And what were the range of education outcomes that you found in those school districts?
Our paper actually wasn't looking specifically at the educational outcomes of the school reforms, because school reform is something that, even after it's implemented, it takes years to really see some significant results. But in general, I can say that all 11 of those schools have not had as good educational outcomes as perhaps more affluent suburban school districts.
And so as you looked at this question of civic capacity and how it is brought to bear on school systems, what did you find in those 11 school districts?
Well, we tended to find that while there was a lot of variation in terms of how organized the stakeholders were in terms of forming a kind of governing body, there were several school districts that did quite well. There was a lot of agreement among the stakeholders as to who were the important decision makers in educational politics. We also found that there was a lot more agreement among these stakeholders about what the problems were. And when it came to solutions, there was a lot of disagreement. So it seems like stakeholders have a pretty easy time figuring out what the problems are, but they're not real good at figuring out what the solutions or agreeing on what the appropriate solutions are going to be. And then the third thing we found really was that the school systems that tended to have more cohesive governing arrangements and more agreement about problems and solutions were the ones that tended to have more primary role of the mayor in educational politics and policymaking.
But, Melissa, you can't yet link cohesive and sustained policy with education outcomes.
No, we can't. The original study that was done in 1993 and 94. So we went back and looked at newspaper reports of what the major problems and reform solutions were on the agenda in those cities, and we tried to match the interviews that had been done with the local stakeholders to what was actually going on in the cities. And we've kind of followed those cities over time. We're working on a follow-up project that would look at kind of the same methodology to see kind of where these cities are and to track what kind of progress they've made over time, mm-hmm. both in terms of what the reforms they were working on, you know, 10, 12 years ago, and then where they are in terms of educational outcomes.
The average tenure of school superintendents is, I'm not sure what it is today. Melissa, do you know?
For big urban school districts, it's about 2.5 years.
2.5 years. And these school systems are huge.
Right.
Many of them have 100,000 plus children, 40,000 plus employees. Is it this lack of cohesiveness among the stakeholders that drives superintendents out so quickly?
I think a lot of it has to do with the scapegoating that might go on. I mean, the superintendents tend to come in with a particular policy idea in mind, a reform that's kind of worked maybe somewhere else, and they come in with that idea and they maybe have a year or two to kind of launch it. And then if there are no immediate results, which is typically the case, the school board tends to point the finger at the superintendent and say, it's not working, we need someone else, and they start the whole process all over again.
And inevitably that causes policy and program churn at the local level, and common sense would tell you that that inconsistency must be hurting student performance. Surely it hurts morale of employees.
And if you talk to a lot of teachers, they kind of learn to adapt to the system where they are so accustomed to having the reform of the day or the reform of the year, which, you know, may have some implications for what they do in the classroom, but a lot of times they try to work around it because they realize that probably in a year or in a few months there'll be something new.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Melissa Marshall and Peru Shaw. They are co-authors of the new report, Keeping Policy Churn Off the Agenda, Urban Education and Civic Capacity. I have had mayors talk to me about their involvement in schools. And some don't want to go as far as taking over their schools. I think for whatever reason, they don't want the responsibility, but they want to exercise a level of influence and involvement greater than the mayor in that city has traditionally had. Can you describe for me, Peru, the different levels of involvement a mayor might have in his or her schools?
Before the start of having many schools have mayoral takeovers, traditionally mayors have had taken a back seat in terms of what's going on specifically in their schools. They may have had some influence on the hiring of the superintendent, and in that way have somebody directly under them who is responsible for the school system and influence their policies in a much more indirect manner. The newer models that have mayors in charge of the school board or appointing a superintendent really gives the mayor much more control over specifically school policies, school finance, and who is setting the school policies, especially if they're appointing the school boards.
And you generally think that's a good thing?
I don't know if I would say that I think it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think that it gives the school district the ability to have one person who potentially is the person who's in charge of all the policies and gives parents, all the stakeholders, somebody to look to and say, why are things going one way or not the other? On the other hand, it doesn't allow for as much decentralized control at the school level. Parents and community members, their voices may not be heard if the mayor and his appointed school board and superintendent are running the show.
Melissa, can you tell us which cities have mayors in charge of their schools?
At the time of our study, actually, both Baltimore and Boston had mayor-centric forms of school governance. Baltimore had had that form for quite a while. Interestingly enough, in 1997, Baltimore, the legislature took some of the power away from the mayor in that system. Boston is still going strong with their system of mayoral appointment over the school board, and also the superintendent sits on the school committee. So the superintendent actually works together with the mayor and the school committee members. Chicago was probably one of the most popular mayoral takeover systems in 1995. There have been several other districts that have kind of used their model, for example, Cleveland and the D.C. system as well.
When you look at the downside of mayoral takeover of schools, and clearly we're moving in that direction, they're becoming more common, as in the list you just gave us indicates, what are the downsides of that kind of takeover?
That is the perception among parents and community members that they really have no voice anymore. And I think the New York City example is a pretty prominent one, because at the same time the mayor took over the school system, he abolished the system of community elected school boards. In New York City, there used to be 32 elected school boards. It was a somewhat decentralized system of government, and especially since they actually extended voting rights to non-citizens. So there's a lot of immigrants in urban school systems who are already shut out of the system. They don't get to vote on budgets. They don't get to vote in school board elections. And in a few cases like Chicago and New York, they've had that ability. That was recently taken away in New York.
Among the school systems you looked at, where did you see the most promise?
It seems like maybe Boston has continued to maintain a lot of cohesiveness and cooperation among the key stakeholders. It's probably important to really look consistently over time at what's going on in all of these districts, and there's just so many different things happening that we need to sit down and really go back through our data again and see what's going on in all 11 of those cities before we could really say.
The report is Keeping Policy Churn Off the Agenda, Urban Education and Civic Capacity. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Melissa Marshall and Peru Shaw authored the report Keeping Policy Churn Off the Agenda, Urban Education and Civic Capacity. City View's commentator Walker Smith joins us weekly to give us his very personal view of life in cities.
I've always avoided birthdays. In fact, it's fair to say that I just flat out hate them. My own birthdays, that is. I'm happy to join in and celebrate someone else's birthday, just not my own. Needless to say, this drives my family and friends crazy. Celebrating anniversaries is a part of human nature. We mark passages with rituals and ceremonies, and that, I suppose, is exactly why I avoid birthdays. Getting older is not something I want to observe or commemorate. Historians have found evidence of birthday celebrations dating back thousands of years. In many ancient pagan cultures, major life changes like turning a year older were thought to put a person at greater risk from evil spirits. So birthdays were observed with fun and good cheer to fend off the evil spirits lurking about. People were surrounded and protected by good wishes and happy thoughts. These early birthday celebrations weren't about the person with the birthday so much as they were about the community coming together to embrace and look after a member of that community. While the individual was the focus of everyone's efforts, the community was the force at work. In coming together, the community asserted its power and authority in order to vanquish threats to its collective strength and integrity. The connection of the individual to the community at large was reinforced and validated. Or to put it another way, birthday celebrations were more for the guest than for the guest of honor. Getting older is not what birthdays should celebrate, but aging gets most of the attention nowadays, which is why I avoid birthdays. A 2002 survey of 50 to 80-year-olds conducted at the University of Sussex in England found that few liked the fact that birthdays signify getting older, and that many disliked the increasing commercialization of birthday celebrations. But everyone thought that birthdays should be remembered because they are occasions on which the ties of family and friendship can be commemorated and reasserted. In other words, birthdays are for everyone else. And this, of course, is what makes my family and friends crazy about my avoidance of birthdays. My birthdays aren't about me. They're about the other people in my life and their chance to come together in a celebration of our ties and connections. As my youngest sister admonished me on my last birthday, the dreaded 5-0, the day of my birth is one of the most important days in my mother's life. My mother doesn't want to toast the fact that I'm getting old. She wants to remember that happy day in the life of our family. My sister is right, of course. Avoiding my birthdays is not simply a personal choice because my birthdays are for other people, too. It's a family celebration, not a selfish occasion. I guess you have to get older even to see this truth. Now I just need to get old enough to accept it with grace and thanks. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.
You're listening to Smart City.